Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Rudolf Penner, a fellow at the Urban Institute, where he is the holder of the R.J. and Francis Miller Chair in Public Policy, previously serving as the director of the Congressional Budget Office from 1983 to 1987, as well as a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and managing director of the Barents Group, a KMPG company. He'll speak on the topic, The Hard Road to Fiscal Responsibility. Mr. Penner's appearance was co-sponsored by the UNO College of Public Affairs and Community Service and the Great Plains Government Finance Officers Association. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 4, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is John Bartle, Acting Dean, and David Scott Diamond Professor of Public Affairs at the College of Public Affairs and Community Service.
Dr. Penner worked for many of the key federal agencies, economic organizations, the Council of Economic Advisors, Office of Management and Budget, and also served, very importantly, as the director of the Congressional Budget Office. If you're not familiar with the Congressional Budget Office, it was created in 1974, and at the time had one director. Rudy was the second director of the CBO. And think about it. I mean, for those of you who think about organizations, maybe you've been with a new organization, you know, any organization where you have an initial and inaugural director, okay, things kind of get formed a little bit around that person's approach and in important ways. But in many cases, the second person is as important, if not maybe more important, because do they carry on those traditions? Do they change them? The structure of the organization? And Rudy did, I think, a great service to our country in his work with CBO. It was a really critical period of that time. He came in was 83 or 84, Rudy? 83. Right when I left. I left Washington, and he got his promotion, or his new job. But I want to read to you something, and I'll try to be brief here. I know it's dangerous to put a professor at a podium with a book in his hand, but I think this is really very important and well said. This is from a recent book called The Congressional Budget Office by Phil Joyce, who is a professor at the University of Maryland, and he writes a history of the organization. He says, it is hard to overstate the contribution made by the second director. Rudy Penner certainly made many other positive contributions to the organization, but perhaps his main gift to the organization was in what he did not do. He established the practice, almost universally followed by subsequent directors, of assuming that the staff would be responsive and that this responsiveness transcended allegiance to party or individual director. He continued and facilitated the institutional expectations of neutral competence. Eloquent testimony to the most important quality of CBO directors, which is the ability to play it straight, regardless of whether you are a nominal Democrat or a nominal Republican. Roy Myers argued that Rudy made an incredible contribution to the organization in that he was just as good as Alice, although with different skills. Alice Rivlin, the previous director, the inaugural director. Once Penner, a Republican, had demonstrated that the mission of the institution needed to transcend the political affiliation of its director, it set an important precedent for subsequent directors to follow, and they really all have. So you know, you can see how this created an organization that went from not even existing in 1974 to in 1993, when Bill Clinton, in his State of the Union address, you may remember, somewhat famously told the Congress, we'll use your office to estimate the budget, because if you don't trust my office, we'll use your office. And so less than 20 years later, it became the source of trusted information. It had been, but so much so that the president deferred to the Congress's budget office instead of his own. Really a remarkable transformation. In Nebraska, we expect nonpartisanship, competence, and straightforward talk in our government. we're frustrated when we don't see it in Washington. And I think sometimes we tend to think, well, it's all that way. They're all a bunch of fools, and what are they doing there? But it exists in pockets. Obviously, there there's problems in some areas, but there's lots of good people in other areas. And Rudy Penner is one of them. And so, again, he really did, I think, a great deal for our nation in that. He also set an example for me as a professional, an example that focused on diligent competence, on honest discussion, and on good good writing that was accessible. I can remember the first couple drafts of things I wrote were given back saying, you know, make this more comprehensible. And that's a skill that stayed with me for a long time. So it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Rudy Penner.
Well, thank you, John, for that very nice introduction. As Lyndon Johnson once said to a glowing introduction, my father would have been proud and my mother would have believed it. John invited me today to talk about the federal budget so that I could really depress you, and I'll do my best in that task. I have been working around budgets for about 40 years, and this is the most dangerous situation that I can remember. Our debt is growing far faster than our economy. The ratio of the debt to GDP is growing at an increasing rate. And the CBO now projects, with a reasonable definition of continuing current policy, that we'll reach something like 200% of the GDP by 2037. Now, few countries get that far, and in fact, we won't get that far. People will stop lending to us long before we get there. And these numbers are biased toward optimism, because if we go on a path with big deficits, that drains our national saving, and it means we have less left over to create wealth in this country and depresses our future incomes. And the numbers I just gave you take no account of that whatsoever. They assume the economy is not affected by these gargantuan deficits. The arithmetic underlying the deficit is devilishly simple, but very hard to get across to the general public. There are really only two program areas that are causing a problem here. One is Social Security, the other is health. And those two program areas all by themselves take up almost half of non-interest spending for the federal government. And that's very hard to get across to the public. They think most of it's foreign aid or something else they don't like. These are not only the main problems, they're really the only problems in the budget. Defense, over the long run, interrupted by wars, of course, has been on a long decline from being about 50% of our budget to being quite tiny now. Welfare programs are not growing in the long run. So it's really just health and just Social Security. And the reason these things are growing fast, probably well known to you, but it's because of the aging of the population, especially with the baby boomers applying for Social Security and Medicare. And while it is certainly true that it costs more to provide health to an older person than a younger person, at every age level, the cost of providing health care is growing faster than incomes. So CBO tries to divide this up, and they attribute 68% of the growth in these programs through 2037 to the aging of the population, and 32% to the excess cost of health care. Now, there's another dimension to the aging population that's not reflected in these numbers, and that is that the population on average is getting older, both because there are more old people, but also because there are relatively fewer young people. So the baby boomers and the Gen Xers didn't really have enough kids to support them well in their old age. So it's not too late for some of you to do your share. We badly need some little potential taxpayers here. But it is the slowdown in the growth of the number of taxpayers that is very largely responsible for our budget problems. Now, just another way to put the extraordinary growth in Social Security and health. In 1990, they accounted for 6.9% of the GDP. This year, they're already up over 10%, and by 2037, CBO estimates them at almost 17% of the GDP. Well, when you talk about possible solutions to this problem, there are really a lot of very severe restraints on what we can do. So the problem, Social Security and health, the biggest health program by far is Medicare. And Social Security and Medicare are essentially retirement programs. Well, that means that you really can't change them abruptly, because obviously people plan for their retirement over a number of decades, and they want to be able to rely on these programs to some degree. And so whatever you do, you should gradually phase it in. Now, there's a consensus developing in Washington, which is part of the Romney position, that shouldn't do anything at all for 10 years, so that no one would be affected who's 55 or older by any Social Security or Medicare reform. I think that goes far too far, just by asking the older people to contribute a little bit, because this is a problem that's like compounding interest rates. You could help out the younger people, or do much less, I should say, to the younger people. But that is not the consensus among politicians. So it'll be a long time before we see any saving from the two programs that are the biggest cause of our budget problem. The other problem right now is that the economy is in such a fragile state. It seems to be getting more fragile every day. You don't want to suddenly hit it with big tax increases or benefit cuts. So that is slowing down. And the difficult political problem is that I don't know of any programs ever invented that have been as politically popular as Social Security and Medicare. And I find talking to audiences of ordinary Americans, they just can't believe that such wonderful programs could be the cause of such large budget problems. But they are. And of course, in Washington now, we have this incredible polarization of the parties, which is, which reflects to a large degree, I think, the polarization of the population. The population is getting more extreme Democratic or extreme Republican all the time, and we divide them up into districts with clever line drawing for the House that makes the districts even more extreme. So it's very hard to get the least bit of compromise. And this is a really budget-wonkish kind of point, which will probably bore you. But our budget process has a strong bias in it against discretionary programs. By that, I mean programs that are appropriated by the Congress every year, and entitlement programs, which basically the Congress never has to look at if they don't have to. They just go on. And so the discretionary program, to the extent we've made a little bit of progress, and we have in cutting the deficit, the focus has really been strongly on discretionary programs. So we are about to really squeeze defense, education, law and order, programs of that sort. And one of the things that this bifurcation of the budget process does is to change the definition of a cut. If the Congress doesn't appropriate enough defense to make up for inflation, it said they're cutting defense, and that's a proper description of what they're doing. It has less real purchasing power. If they cut the growth of Social Security benefits from 5 to 4%, that's called a cut, even though every year the Social Security beneficiary is getting better and better off. So that means that it's very susceptible to demagoguery, and politicians tend to scare the oldsters to death by talking about cuts in Social Security, when in fact benefits would continue to rise, except not as much as they are under, or are supposed to under current law. Well, we have had a number of committees and commissions in Washington that are attempting to do something about this whole thing. Probably the most famous is the Bowles-Simpson Committee. This is probably the gold standard of proposals. And I think everybody who looks at the budget situation, and I'll probably repeat myself several times through here, comes back to this as being a practical, balanced package. But what they do, first of all, is to propose a radical tax reform. They want to get rid of the underbrush of numerous deductions and exclusions and special treatment in the tax code, which will bring in a lot of revenue. And they have different options, but basically they want to use some of that revenue to lower rates and some of it to reduce the deficit. And their plan would actually raise $80 billion in 2015 and $180 billion by 2020. So it's fairly significant on the tax side. One of their options is extreme. You just get rid of everything, and you can lower the tax top rate, I think it's to around 25%. But that's really hard, because there are these sensitive, politically sensitive deductions like the home interest deduction, charitable deductions, and so on. So another of their options, they put these aside and they just reduce their value. They don't eliminate them altogether. Their plan is highly progressive because they tax capital gains and dividends at full rates, and to the extent the rich pay lower taxes than other people, it's because of the favoritism toward those things. You can have a very good argument, and maybe we'll get into it in the discussion period, as to whether that's a good idea or not. I tend to favor a progressive consumption tax, which would treat those things very differently. Would not tax them if you reinvested them, but would tax them if you use them for consumption. But that is a very profound argument, and most of the discussion today is based around the income tax as opposed to having a radical change from that. They do a very interesting Social Security reform. Again, to the extent there's a consensus in Washington, so we should do something called progressive indexing. Right now, all benefits are indexed to wages. That means they'll grow. That is the initial benefit. That means that average benefits will grow through time as wages grow through time. And it's really that growth we can't afford. We can afford today's level of benefits adjusted for inflation forever. What we can't afford is the promise we've made to forever increase those benefits in real terms. So what Bowles-Simpson does is say, okay, let's take the people who had lower wage growth in their lifetime. We'll give them the benefits that are promised by current law. But for the people higher up the wage scale, we'll slow down the rate of growth of indexing. And they also increase the normal retirement age, but at a very, very slow rate. And they have... I call it a small payroll tax increase. Maybe it isn't that small over the very long run, but it is small at first. And like everybody else, they're very hard on discretionary spending. You almost have to be. If you really want to just have the reform of the retirement programs very gradually, you don't save much at first. And if you don't want to raise taxes a whopping amount, there's really nowhere else to go but discretionary spending and a few other mandatory type spending like farm programs. So all of these groups are very hard on discretionary spending, even though, as I've said, that is not a big cause of our budget problems. Now, the really big hole in Bowles-Simpson is that they don't make a specific proposal about Medicare in the long run. That's partly because they were working just as Obamacare was being debated. It is a big weakness in their proposal looked at today. And it's the reason, by the way, that Paul Ryan said he voted against it. He was on the commission. A lot of people say he voted against it because of tax increases. That is not what he said publicly. A very similar set of recommendations was done by a private group run by former Senate Budget Chairman Pete Domenici and Alice Rivlin, the first director of CBO, and have very similar proposals for Social Security, for tax reform. None of the spending cuts were quite as dramatic as in Bowles-Simpson, but they did have what is called a premium support plan for Medicare, where you would limit its budget. The fundamental problem with Medicare today is that the budget is totally unlimited. We specify in the law who's eligible. We specify what kind of treatments they can have. We exclude hardly nothing. And then we just pay for everybody that walks in the door. We try to control costs with a price control system that would make the Soviet Union proud. But it works about as well as price control systems did in the Soviet Union, and it's never been effective. So instead, this group and Ryan and Romney would specify a budget, like they do, by the way, in countries like Canada and the United Kingdom, where they have public health plans. They have a budget, and the system has to live within the budget. And it's not pretty how they do that, but they do live within the budget. So they would have a budget, and they would give vouchers or subsidies to individuals to go out and shop for insurance. And hopefully the competition would improve the efficiency of our health care delivery system, but that is not certain. In fact, everything in health is very uncertain. I think we have basically no idea what Obamacare will cost in the long run, from virtually tiny amounts to gargantuan amounts, depending on how it evolves. And that's the trouble. That's what makes health reform so difficult. Well, the other thing that they do is introduce a value-added tax. So they're heavier on the tax side than is Bowles-Simpson. And when I said before that Bowles-Simpson seems to have a lot of appeal among various groups in Washington, I just meant in very general terms. I didn't mean very specifically point by point. But by general appeal, I mean that you got to solve this problem on both sides of the budget. There has to be entitlement reform. There has to be some tax increases. And there's just really no way of getting around that when you look at the arithmetic of the whole thing. Well, the House Republican budget, which was put together by Paul Ryan and has to some degree been adopted by Romney, though he's more generous than the budget was. Again, it has this premium support plan for Medicare. Ryan has made it more generous over time. And he would do away, of course, with health reform. Has blocked grants for Medicaid, treats Medicaid much as we treat TANF today. Romney would have only CPI growth plus 1%, which is probably totally unrealistic, with Medicare growing very much faster than that in terms of costs. And again, he would have very stringent caps on civilian discretionary spending, and that would be very, very difficult to attain. The kind of caps that he is talking about without really unrealistic cuts in discretionary spending. Depending how you compute it, maybe as much as 40%, which is not thinkable, really. And he has a tax reform plan that's similar to Simpson-Bowles, but except he has no revenue increases. But if you really believe that whole plan, it would stabilize the debt-GDP ratio. Well, the president's response to all of that is that he relies on the health reform to curb Medicare and Medicaid growth. They have all kinds of experimental things in that, electronic records, accountable care organizations, and so on. CBO did not feel able to give big savings for all that stuff because they thought it was all very uncertain. And it is very uncertain. He does back it up. He says he'll sequester health spending if these other things don't curb the growth, but whether you could get away with that politically is not at all clear. And, of course, he has the famous tax increases on the rich. He, like Romney, doesn't even want to touch Social Security. It's too politically difficult. They both promised to have bipartisan cooperation to fix the system, so that's reassuring. He had an automatic mechanism to control the deficit, but he's never talked about it again. It's buried in the budget very deep. It's kind of interesting. It's a kind of sequester mechanism. But the president's plan does not solve the problem. Even taken literally, it would not stabilize the debt-GDP ratio in the long run. So we're in the unfortunate position where I think neither candidate for president really has a credible plan for fixing this problem. And given the size of the problem, I find that pretty scary. Now, I know that a lot of you are in state and local governments, and I don't know how carefully you've been listening, but all the plans would be extremely difficult for state and local governments. Because as I said before, all the plans hit discretionary spending very hard, and about one-third of domestic discretionary spending is in grants to state and local government. And all the tax reform plans that I have seen would eliminate or greatly reduce the value of the deduction for state income taxes and for local real estate taxes and so forth. So all, I think, would make it a lot more difficult to a lot more difficult to raise taxes at the state and local level. Well, one thing I haven't talked about, which should be on everybody's mind right now, is this so-called fiscal cliff. In recent years, mainly to avoid problems, when the Congress has passed anything that would reduce revenues or raise spending, they've done it on a temporary basis. If they just done it, CBO would have to project that it would increase the deficit for a very long time, but they say we'll end this tax cut or we'll end this restraint, this increase in spending within a year. So when CBO projects something like that, they got to take the Congress word. They can't make a political forecast themselves. So they got to, even though some of these tax cuts have been extended year after year after year, they've got to assume they would end, as it says in the legislation. So the Congress has been passing more and more of these things, and suddenly, by accident to some degree, all of these things are going to end December 31st of this year. And it is an incredible list. It's the Bush income tax cuts. It's the estate tax will go down to a low exemption, so I'd strongly recommend you don't die in 2013. You'd have the alternative minimum tax affecting millions of more people. You have new taxes coming from the health reform, the surtax on the investment income of richer people. The temporary payroll tax cut that was passed for stimulus reasons will expire. There are all kinds of other, there's a long list of other temporary tax provisions like the research and experimentation tax credit. On the spending side, doctors serving Medicare would get a 27% cut immediately in reimbursements. Won't be many doctors willing to take Medicare under those circumstances. The unemployment insurance extension expires. And then we have this horrible sequester. The Congress put it when they were debating the debt limit, that wonderful debate of a year ago last summer, they created this prospect that if the Congress didn't save $1.2 trillion over 10 years by rational means, it'd have this incredibly irrational cut go into effect. And the whole idea was that this was so stupid and unthinkable, the Congress would certainly agree to do something more rational. Well, they didn't. And so that's on the books for January 1st. I administered a 2% sequester when I was at CBO, and it's just bizarre. Every little budget account and activity has to be cut by the same amount, whether it's a good activity, a bad activity, or so-so activity. So we had to figure out how to cut the House barbershop, the House chaplain, how to cut payments to spies abroad. All kinds of things, happy things like that. There's just no way you can overemphasize the irrationality of this whole thing. It would be the biggest fiscal shock since World War II. Just the tax increases would be the biggest in our history, except for one in World War II. So it is really big. The CBO believes that if this actually goes through, we shall have a recession. They think it'd be a short recession, but 2 million more people would be unemployed, so that's nothing to sneeze at, especially given where we start. I think that they've underestimated the damage because, first of all, they assumed the economy would be stronger when they made that those estimates than it actually is today. And it's their estimate was based on sort of Keynesian economics, the aggregate demand effects. But the real problem here, I think, is psychological. Already the business community, because of the great uncertainty being caused by this, is retarding hiring and investment decisions. And that's part of the reason the economy is quite weak right now. If this thing goes through, I think they'll be totally paralyzed. They won't know what's going to happen next. And besides, it's not as though people are very proud of our government right now. I mean, the disillusionment with our political processes would, I think, really soar if we go through with this. Now, you'd asked me 3 months ago, I would have said, oh, they won't do anything this crazy. No way. They'll just extend everything yet again. But there's some Democrats and some on the left who think they should go over the fiscal cliff. They think they can blame the Republicans, and they can because they'll successfully blame the Republicans will quickly agree to do what the Democrats want. I'll tell you, it's not the Republicans I know, but this is a very very strong belief among some. I don't know whether it's a majority, but some. Patty Murray outlined the strategy in a speech before Brookings in July. And there's some Republicans who don't think it'd be a bad thing for even more absurd reasons. I don't know if you've heard this pledge that Grover Norquist has made Republicans sign that so they'll never, ever think of tax increases. Well, if you fall over the cliff, taxes will go up so much, you can then vote to cut them. So some Republicans who'd like to raise revenues could vote to cut taxes and still have a higher tax burden in next year than this. So that is really crazy. So I'm really worried that by accident we could see us plunging over this cliff. And as if all of this wasn't enough, in February or March, we're going to hit the legal limit on our national debt again. So if you remember the edifying debate of a year ago last summer, we're very likely to go through that again. And that really complicates the problems further. Well, can all these problems be avoided? Sure. I mean, the sensible thing to do would be to simply extend everything, then cross your heart and hope to die, to really promise to fix things up in 6 months or a year. Of course, we'd go through the same thing again in 6 months or a year. But in my view, even though you'd take that risk, the damage done by going over this cliff is so severe that it really is unthinkable. Well, is there any hope in the future? I don't want to totally depress you all. You see some breaks in this partisan divide that I talked about. On the Fiscal Commission, one of the really good things about it and a thing that gives some hope is that they did reach a bipartisan agreement. They did get a majority vote in favor of their recommendations, not a sufficient supermajority to force it to be put before the Congress. But they did work together, unbelievably. And really extreme conservative, like Senator Coburn, he's retiring, so maybe it doesn't count, but he voted for the tax increases. And his conservative credentials are above none, are second to none, I should say. Senator Crapo from Idaho played a very positive role on the committee. He's quite conservative, and he voted for tax increases. Senator Durbin, whose liberal credentials can't be denied, voted for the Social Security reform. Then when it came to the super committee, Republicans like Senator Toomey and Hensarling, whom I thought were the most extreme anti-tax people in the Congress, actually put a proposal on the table with some tax increases in it. Very small ones, but still. The Democrats came back with some very tiny reforms in the entitlements. I thought, at that point they should have started to compromise, but they never did. They basically walked away. And there are many groups meeting on Capitol Hill. One had some promise with Senator Warner and Senator Chambliss, a bipartisan group, been working hard. A lot of groups. But they are strongly opposed by their leadership, and they get very unpopular with the rest of their parties if they seem to be cooperating. So there are these small rays of light, but they are very, very small. I don't see the election clarifying the picture, as I said before. Both candidates really have implausible promises. When you think about it, Romney's promise never to raise taxes on anybody isn't really that different from Obama's promise never to raise taxes on the middle class. The problem with rich people is there just aren't enough of them to really solve the budget problem. And it's probably unlikely that any party will dominate all of the results. So are we going to march our way to a sovereign debt crisis similar to that in Greece, Spain, Ireland? I'm afraid it's quite possible. Neil Ferguson has written a 300-year history of sovereign debt crises. And the really interesting thing about these crises in history is that financial markets remain incredibly calm while a country's budget is going to hell. They remain incredibly calm until one day they don't. And then everything breaks loose. A typical pattern is for interest rates to go up 300-400 basis points in a matter of very few days or weeks. Stock markets crumble, and very likely a country goes into recession. But they're totally unpredictable. Ferguson's line is that they can be set off by a bit of bad budget news on an otherwise slow news day. It's that irrational, but it's also that unpredictable. But however we finally solve this problem, whether it's in response to a crisis, and I should say other countries that have fixed themselves up have waited until a crisis or being on the verge of crisis. Other democracies, I should say. Sweden had a terrible crisis. GDP went down 3 years in a row. They fixed up their budget. They reformed their social security system. Canada, in the mid-90s, they weren't in a crisis, but they were right on the brink with interest rates soaring, dollar falling. They fixed themselves up and had quite a big Social Security reform. So eventually it happens. I think if it does happen, you still will see them in the crisis going back to something like Bowles-Simpson, and I mean something like, with some adjustment on the tax side, some adjustment on the spending side. So that's the best bet. So I better stop before I totally ruin your lunch. Are there questions? And remember, wanted you to come to the microphone.
Oh, thank you. You painted a pretty doom and gloom picture of spending trends, and then you have a system like the fiscal cliff that would change that, and you say it's too big of a shock, but wouldn't any major change to that spending trend cause a fiscal shock that would, $1 is a dollar, either way you look at it?
Well, that's right. The problem with the fiscal cliff is that it all happens at once. And if we were designing the ideal fix to the budget, we would phase in slowly some reduction in the rate of growth of spending and some tax increases. There are a lot of economists who think, and by the way, it was in the Domenici-Rivlin Commission, that you should start with an actual stimulus and then promise, to reverse it very gradually and fix the long-run problem gradually. I'm not for that. I have to say, with the exception of possibly falling off the fiscal cliff by accident, the last worry that keeps me up at night is that the Congress will lower the deficit too fast. I just don't think that's going to happen. So if they do it under rational terms, it'll be very slow. So I don't worry about it. Maybe because I'm not as big a Keynesian as some economists, but I think any slowing would be worth it. Yes?
Dr. Penner, you mentioned the sovereign debt crisis element. And you mentioned Greece, Spain, and Ireland. from what I know, the only country that really had sovereign debt problems before the recession was Greece, and the effects spilled over into Spain and Ireland. So if you look at other countries like Japan, they have debt to GDP far in excess of 200%. So maybe just to push back a little bit, you know, do we need, you know, radical change now, or do, as you very much suggested yourself, something more gradual over the long term that looks at some of the long run imbalances that we have in our system?
Well, I disagree slightly with your characterization of places like Spain. With regard to Japan, the thing about Japan is that so much of their debt is owned by government institutions like their vast savings bank network. And when I didn't actually use numbers on the debt, but the numbers I used originally, that's our net debt. It doesn't count what's in the trust funds and so forth, because it is the net debt that shows your vulnerability to interest rate changes. So you want to remove what we own ourselves, as it were. And if you do that for Japan, you get a debt ratio that it's admittedly close to, not far from Greece's, but a lot less than the 200% that's often in IMF documents and so on that always show the gross debt. But it's still a puzzle why Japan can go on as they have. But I would say that, you know, in Spain, I wouldn't blame Greece for Spain. I mean, in Spain, it was a housing bubble of extraordinary dimensions that burst and took the economy down with it and then created a sovereign debt problem. Admittedly, there are the Spanish fiscal situation by a number of measures is no worse than ours. But that doesn't reassure me. In fact, it goes the other way. If you, again, going back to Neil, well, not to Neil Ferguson, but to a book by Reinhart and Rogoff, they point out that more than half the sovereign debt crises in history have occurred with debt-GDP ratios lower than the one we have today. So I think we should be very nervous.
But when you talk about interest rate risk and you know, going up overnight, 200-400 basis points, at what point or what percentage of GDP will that take to be a huge issue? I mean, we talk about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and how much, I guess, quantitative easing can we do to keep that interest rate manipulated low? And also follow up to that, what's the long-term damage or benefit to all the quantitative easing the Fed is doing?
Well, in the long run, the CBO simply estimates that we go to more historical interest rates, I think a little above 5% on the 10-year bond. And even at that rate, our interest bill on the debt quadruples in 10 years. By referring to quantitative easing, you have hit another danger on this that I didn't talk about. I thought I gave you enough bad news. But perhaps the ultimate danger is that instead of financing our deficit by borrowing, we start to finance it by creating money. And in a sense, we're doing that now. You know, we used to depend on China and Japan to buy a lot of our debt. They have really slowed down, especially China. If the numbers aren't very good, but if you believe the numbers, they haven't added to their holdings of U.S. debt much. The big buyer of our debt in the last couple of years has been the Federal Reserve. We would normally refer to that as monetizing our debt. But as they have bought our debt, the money has mostly gone into the excess reserves of banks. In other words, banks aren't using the money to lend. They get the magnificent interest rate of 0.25% or 1% on those reserves, and they seem happy with that. So it hasn't really turned into money yet. You know, it'll turn into money when they start lending the money and people put it in their bank deposits and so forth and so on. If you do that, if you truly monetize your debt, and a lot of countries have in history, you are in really big trouble, sort of. I worked a lot after the fall of communism in former communist countries, and a lot of them did that. I worked in Georgia. That's a country, not our state. Just after they had had 10,000% inflation 1 year. I worked in Bulgaria just as a hyperinflation burst out. Now, the one good thing you got to say about hyperinflation is that it does fix up your budget. The wife of a Bulgarian colleague showed me her pay stub. She had a good job. She was head of the national parks in Bulgaria. And for the month, her pay for the month was worth about $1.50 in American dollar terms. Social Security benefits in those countries were eroded to almost nothing. Now, they didn't have indexed Social Security benefits, but but even if you do, I mean, we only adjust once a year, and obviously if you've had 10,000% inflation, there ain't much left by the next bump up in the Social Security benefit. So it really fixes your budget. You don't have any benefits, you don't pay salaries, you don't do anything. Even though I'm exaggerating some, because legislators start to, you know, raise salaries every few days or so. But you can only do it once. That's the trouble. Because when you have 10,000% inflation, people stop using money. And I saw that before my very eyes in Bulgaria, where there were huge lines at various stores. People wanted to trade their money for wine or cigarettes or anything they could get in real terms. So that is a horror. Now, I take some comfort in the fact that I don't know of one, what I'll call developed country democracy, that's done that since World War II. None of them have resorted to that kind of resorted to printing money to try and fill the deficit. So I don't think we would either. But again, if you want something to be nervous about, the Fed has all these bonds and mortgage-backed securities now, and we're into QE3, and the banks are just sitting on the reserves. And if they suddenly start to use them, the Fed is going to have to start selling bonds like crazy. So we'll have a huge deficit plus the Fed selling bonds. And Lord knows what that will do to interest rates. So there's plenty to be worried about in the Fed policies. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have done QE2. I wouldn't have done QE3. Might have done QE1 because the situation was so dire. But given how they've increased their risks of not being able to get rid of this stuff when they have to, the benefit is tiny. I mean, even people who favor the policy don't claim that it lowers interest rates by more than a few basis points. So I don't see that the trade-off is worth it. If we have to hope or pray for anything, it's that we never, ever resort to solving our problems by printing money. Somebody gave me a $50 trillion Zimbabwe note that was worth about 3 cents, I think. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Rudolf Penner, a fellow at the Urban Institute, where he is the holder of the R.J. and Francis Miller Chair in Public Policy, previously serving as the director of the Congressional Budget Office from 1983 to 1987, as well as a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and managing director of the Barron's Group, a KMPG company. He spoke on the topic, The Hard Road to Fiscal Responsibility. Mr. Penner's appearance was co-sponsored by the UNO College of Public Affairs and Community Service and the Great Plains Government Finance Officers Association. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 4, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.